touch anything on
it. Just in the pocket?
Yep.
Okay, I'm going to start. Today I'm going to talk about evaluation of thyroid function. Probably many of you know some of what I'm going to talk about, but I think it's important to review that from time to time. So initially I'm going to talk about some principles about thyroid physiology, the key things that you should know. Then we'll talk about hyperthyroidism primarily, because hypothyroidism is pretty straightforward. So what are the important principles in thyroid diagnostics? Number one, it is the so-called free hormone hypothesis, which you're all familiar with. Basically what it's stating, that a hormone that circulates in the extracellular fluid can only enter cells if it's free and not bound to a binding protein. And in the case of thyroid hormone, there's a very extreme situation, more so than for any other hormone. And typically I ask when I give this lecture to have people make guesses, but let's skip that part and I just tell you what it is. The percent free thyroid hormone is 0.03%. 99.97% is bound to three different binding proteins. You may recall that those three different binding proteins are thyroxine-binding globulin, also called TBG, transthyretin, which used to be called prealbumin, but it's now called transthyretin, and albumin. TBG is a relatively low affinity but high affinity, low capacity binding protein. Because it has a high affinity, about 80% of the bound hormone is bound to TBG. Transthyretin has an intermediate affinity and binds about 15%. And albumin has a very low affinity, but there's lots of it there. So it binds 5%, roughly. So the difficulty in diagnosing thyroid disease is to assess the free fraction, the free T4. Now you might say, we have the assay. Why don't you just look at the assay? It says free T4. So why do we worry about this? The problem with the assay is the free T4 assay it's a rough approximation. It's not a true free T4 measurement. The way the assay is done, they use a low affinity antibody for capturing the free hormone with the idea that the affinity is so low that TBG has such a much higher affinity that you will not pull off any of the bound hormone and therefore only interact with the free hormone. This sounds good, thank you very much. Sounds very good on paper, but in extreme situation, it does not apply. It doesn't work. So if somebody has very high or very low binding proteins or has what we call the sick euthyroid syndrome, which I will go into a little bit more, then often the free T4 index gives us false results, either too low or too high. Typically, too low when the actual free T4 is normal. So, that's the first point that you should remember about thyroid diagnostics. So even though you're getting a free T4, you cannot totally rely on this being the true free T4. How do we know what the true free T4 is? This, the gold standard is equilibrium dialysis. So take serum, enclose it into a semipermeable membrane. In a dialysis bath, you add labeled thyroid hormone to the bath and let it equilibrate. And then you measure the total, and you can calculate from the equilibration, you can calculate the fraction that is free. And based on the specific activity of what's in the bath. I won't go into more details than that. So this is the gold standard. From that, we know that the 0.03% is free only. Okay, that's the first important point that you should remember when you assess anybody's thyroid hormone function. The second is that you should always think about the feedback. It seems so self-evident that you would say, why does he draw this on the blackboard? It turns out that most people still forget about it. So when you look at thyroid function, you should always think about the feedback. TSH drives the thyroid to produce T4 and T3, and they feed back on the pituitary as well as on the hypothalamus to determine how much TSH is produced. The key thing about this feedback is that the thyroid depends totally on TSH. If you shut off TSH, the thyroid is silent, does not release any thyroid hormone. And if the level of thyroid hormone drops in the blood, TSH goes up very, very rapidly. It's a highly sensitive set point. And the important point is the set point is different for individuals. So my set point may be at a free T4, which has a normal range for a population of let's say 0.6 to 2. My free T4 may be set at a point of 1.8, and somebody else's may be 0.9. If the person with 0.9 goes up to 1.8, the TSH is completely suppressed already in that person. And if I go, let's assume that my free T4 is 1.8, I go down to 0.8, my TSH will be elevated already. So the set point is incredibly sensitive. So the TSH is the most sensitive assay for assessing thyroid hormone function. So therefore, you might ask, why don't we just forget about everything else and just look at TSH? Turns out it's not that simple. So let's get into the diagnostic approach. Hypothyroidism. Well, let's start with hypothyroidism because it's so simple we can get rid of hypothyroidism very quickly. Hypothyroidism. Primary hypothyroidism is obvious what you're going to get, the TSH. Because if the thyroid doesn't produce enough thyroid hormone, the TSH is going to go up. So you obtain a TSH, and if it's elevated, then have you confirmed that the patient has hypothyroidism? That's the next question. Have you? The answer is no. Contrary to what the primary care faculty wants you to believe, that you only need a TSH. That it's not, that it's too much money to order a free T4 with every TSH. The endocrinologists want you to order a free T4 with every TSH, because then you can always think about the feedback. Why is that important? Because there are conditions in which the TSH is elevated and you don't have hypothyroidism. Otherwise, I wouldn't mention it. Not that common, but it can happen. For instance, the rare circumstance. I've seen one case in, I won't tell you how many years I've been here. I've seen one case of a TSH-producing pituitary tumor. Was a slightly elevated TSH? You think, okay, maybe mildly hypothyroid, subclinical perhaps, and you get a T4, it's elevated, and a T3 is elevated. Patient has hyperthyroidism, not hypothyroid. So therefore, the TSH cannot be relied upon by itself. Acutely ill patients, particularly psychiatric patients, the ones that come into the psych ward with acute decompensation, can sometimes have a slightly elevated TSH without hypothyroidism. Without hypothyroidism. So the TSH is for primary hypothyroidism necessary but not sufficient to make the diagnosis of hypothyroidism. So therefore we need the free T4. And if you have that constellation, you've made the diagnosis. If the free T4 is low and the TSH is elevated, you have made the diagnosis of hypothyroidism without any additional tests needed. The other reason why we need both is because when you have secondary hypothyroidism, where you have TSH deficiency that causes hypothyroidism, if you don't measure the free T4, you may miss it. Why may you miss it? Because the TSH will not be undetectable. It will be normal or even slightly elevated in some patients. This is for people hard to understand. Why should that be normal or increased or decreased? All three circumstances you can see in pituitary hypothyroidism. The reason is that when you have pituitary, that doesn't make TSH because it has a tumor or some other pathology within it. There will be a decrease in thyroid hormones because the TSH is down. The true biologically active TSH is down. There will be increased demand for TSH, and the remnant cells that there are crank out something that it looks like TSH, but it's not properly processed. TSH is a glycoprotein hormone, and if it's not properly glycosylated, it can bind to the receptor. But the TSH assay that we use is an immunoassay. It's based on its immunoreactivity, which in this instance is not affected whether or not it's glycosylated or not. So you're detecting both biologically active and biologically inactive TSH. Now you could still say, why should there be any TSH? Because pituitary is not properly making it. I'm saying it makes a little bit biologically inactive TSH. And that has a prolonged half-life because it doesn't get cleared, because the clearance of TSH is by binding to the receptor on the thyroid by receptor-mediated endocytosis. If it can't bind to the receptor, it just hangs around longer. And you measure it and you find an normal or elevated TSH, and the patient, in fact, has TSH deficiency in this hypothyroid. So if you were just measuring the TSH and it's normal, you would say the patient is fine. Turns out that he may have profound hypothyroidism from TSH deficiency. If you then treat that patient and render them euthyroid, eventually the TSH will become essentially undetectable. And then I get calls from the doctor and say, you're giving him too much thyroid hormone because his TSH is completely suppressed. That's the other misunderstanding, okay? If you shut off the demand for TSH, it will disappear eventually. Okay, that's all I'm going to say about hypothyroidism. Any questions? There are a lot of questions about how you treat hypothyroidism, how aggressive, how quickly you render people euthyroid. So that is a topic in itself, really. I want to focus this talk primarily on diagnostics. So now we come to hyperthyroidism. So in hyperthyroidism, again, we get the TSH and the free T4 as our initial tests. That should be the panel. Don't get any other tests. Forget about resin uptake and... Once you have established somebody has hyperthyroidism or thyroid disease, then you can get a TPO antibody to gives you some idea whether they have autoimmune thyroid disease or not. it is helpful, but it's not essential to treat the patient. So what's essential is to know whether or not they have hyperthyroidism or hypothyroidism. So what do you expect from a TSH to be when you're hyperthyroid? Obviously, it should be suppressed, right? So again, the question is, when you have a suppressed TSH, is that sufficient to make the diagnosis? Do we really need the free T4? Or are there other circumstances in which the TSH can be suppressed and you don't have hyperthyroidism? And it turns out the latter is the case. What are the circumstances? The most notorious one is the sick euthyroid patient. In other words, somebody who has no problem, the thyroid is working perfectly normally, gets sick, acutely or chronically ill. Three things happen to these patients. The first thing that was discovered was that these patients have a low T3. When the T3 assay came around, they started measuring it, and everybody found that if you starve yourself, your T3 falls. If you are malnourished, if you are sick, chronically or acutely ill, the T3 falls. Let's digress from the TSH and ask why that is. Why does the T3 fall? There's a metabolism of T4 that is primarily metabolism of deiodination. Reverse T3. So T4 can be deiodinated initially in the outer ring or in the inner ring. There are two benzoyl rings. Each one has two iodine molecules. If you take one iodine out of the outer ring, you go to T3. This is the activating metabolism. T3 is the thyroid hormone. If you look in any tissue in the body and ask which hormone is sitting at the nuclear receptor for T3, for thyroid hormone, T3 only. You will not find any T4 in any nuclear receptor in any cell. Affinity of the nuclear receptor for T3 is much higher than for T4. So T4 is a pre-hormone for T3, a precursor. The metabolism can also go to what we call reverse T3. And that is if another enzyme can take out the inner iodine. And that is an inactivating mutation. This reverse T3 has absolutely no biological activity. It's biologically inactive, as far as people can tell from multiple attempts to find any kind of biological activity of this molecule. It's a step in the degradation that goes then on to T2 and other oxidation pathways. So it's important to just look at the two types of enzymes that are involved in this metabolism. One is what we call a 5' deiodinase that catalyzes T4 to T3 conversion, the activating conversion. And the other one is a 5-deiodinase. In which T4 goes to T2 and becomes inactivated. Interestingly enough, the T3 also ultimately goes to T2 and using the same enzyme. So what happens is, in sick people, coming back to the sick euthyroid situation, this enzyme, the 5' deiodinase, which is an extracellular enzyme, or it's an enzyme that's primarily in the kidney and in the liver, that accounts for 80% of our circulating T3 in our extracellular fluid. The thyroid predominantly secretes T4, and a little bit of T3 under normal circumstances. And of the T3 that we have circulating, 80% of that is derived by peripheral conversion. After release of T4 from the thyroid, the periphery, we make T3 by this 5' deiodinase. And this enzyme is very susceptible to insults of metabolic disturbances, cytokines, malnutrition, etc. So that's why the first thing that happens in patients that are sick, the T3 level drops. In everybody, pretty much. We can come back to this in a moment, if you wish. The second thing that was detected was that there is a fall in TSH. That's why a low TSH doesn't automatically should lead you to the conclusion that the patient is hyperthyroid. Why does the TSH form when you get sick? Because the response of the thyrotroph, the cells in the pituitary that make TSH, to TRH, it comes from the brain, from the hypothalamus. That response is impaired in sick people, particularly, again, cytokines, steroids, stress. In stressed people, you have an impaired ability of the thyrotroph to respond to TRH, and therefore your TSH may fall. It turns out in sick people, when you get very sick, so if you check your TFTs in the intensive care unit where people are really sick, you find that they also have a very low T4. So they have low T3, low TSH, and low T4. And if you measure the free T4, like we down in standard do, often it comes back low. Even though if you do equilibrium dialysis in these patients, they have perfectly normal or slightly elevated free T4. There are a number of studies that have looked at that. So this is the circumstance where the free T4 cannot be trusted. So now, when you have this constellation, you have a problem, because you look at this panel of low T3, low TSH, low free T4, and you say, well, looks like the patient has pituitary insufficiency. That would explain the whole thing. So can you distinguish that? Most of the time you can do it clinically, and therefore we don't do any tests. First of all, we don't check TFTs in the ICU. I strongly advise against it, unless you strongly suspect thyroid disease. But if you do it, then you have one. There's one possibility. What you can do is you can measure reverse T3. We don't do it because we typically can decide without this that the patient has sick thyroid. But if you wanted to, you could determine reverse T3. Now, why would that be helpful? Because both T3 and reverse T3 are only derived from free T4. The metabolism, just like the biological activity of hormone, only happens on the free hormone, not on the bound hormone. So, in hypothyroidism, be it primary or secondary, if the T4 is low, free T4 is truly low, then you're not going to make either much T3 or reverse T3. Both of them are going to be low because the substrate is low. The product is going to be low. However, if this is normal or even elevated, but let's say it's normal, but your T3 is low, then this will be normal or even elevated, because there's no inhibition of this enzyme that converts T4 to reverse T3. And because that enzyme, and this enzyme is inhibited, as we said, so you're generating the normal amount of reverse T3, but you're not converting it to T2. And therefore, it can actually go up. So if you measure in sick people, everything is low, and you measure the reverse T3, you find it's normal or high. you've ruled out hypothyroidism. It's very, very useful, okay? We don't do it because the lab, in order to make it worthwhile for the lab to do it, they have to have enough demand for it. If they don't, then it becomes cost ineffective to set up an assay. So I won't say anything more about this part. Okay, so I said that TSH suppression is not sufficient to make the diagnosis of hypothyroidism, but it's necessary. So you can come back and ask yourself again, is it really necessary? Maybe there are some patients with hypothyroidism even that don't have a suppressed TSH. I already mentioned one of those examples, the rare pituitary tumor that produces TSH. You will have hypothyroidism, and it's because of the TSH overproduction, the TSH is not going to be suppressed. Are there any other condition in which the TSH is not suppressed and yet you are truly hypothyroid? There is one other condition, and one can argue whether you're really truly hypothyroid or not, but where you have elevated thyroid hormone levels and the TSH is not suppressed, is normal. And that is thyroid hormone resistance. If you're born with a defective thyroid hormone receptor, and the thyroid hormone receptor is a dimer that binds to a DNA response element with two alleles, one from each allele. You have two partners that bind, and you need both together to turn on thyroid hormone action, on gene expression. If you have one of those partners defective because of a mutation, if you're born with one mutation, then you get, in fact, autosomal dominant thyroid hormone resistance because the dimer is unproductive if one partner is not biologically active. So you get what's called a dominant negative effect, even though it's a recessive mutation, if you wish. It's not a dominant mutation in the sense that loss of, but it causes a dominant effect by inhibiting the biological activity of the other partner. So in thyroid hormone resistance, you can have a normal TSH and you have very high levels of thyroid hormone. You won't see many of those patients. I won't go over those in detail. They're quite rare, fortunately. So the bottom line is, to make the diagnosis of hypothyroidism, you want to be sure that your TSH is suppressed, unless you consider the possibility the patient may have a pituitary tumor. And you want to also see that the free T4 is elevated to confirm that the patient has hypothyroidism. That constellation makes the diagnosis of hypothyroidism. Nothing else can explain that constellation but hypothyroidism. Unfortunately, not every patient with hypothyroidism has that constellation. Some patients with hypothyroidism have a suppressed TSH and a normal free T4, and they're still hypothyroid, because they have T3 toxicosis. Their TSH is suppressed and their T3 is elevated and the free T4 is in the normal range. It's called T3 toxicosis. This is the condition in which the overstimulated thyroid, overstimulated, for instance, by thyroid-stimulating immunoglobulins, like in Graves' disease. The thyroid can become more efficient, and instead of secreting primarily T4, it can actually intrathyroidally convert more T4 to T3 and secrete directly T3. A higher proportion of it comes directly out of T3. Then you don't need the peripheral conversion. So you can become hypothyroid without getting an increase in the free T4. It's not that uncommon, and you should definitely know about it. So therefore, if you get this constellation of a suppressed TSH and a normal free T4, and you still suspect hypothyroidism because you don't have a good explanation for the suppressed TSH, then you measure the T3. If that's low, then you think about this. Sick euthyroid. If it's high, then you have made the diagnosis of T3 toxicosis. All right. So, we have made the diagnosis of hypothyroidism. And I haven't spent a word on talking about subclinical hyper or hypothyroid. I should maybe mention it. It's a somewhat unfortunate terminology. Because subclinical hypothyroidism should mean as somebody who is hypothyroid but doesn't have any symptoms. That would be the correct definition of subclinical hypothyroidism. But the way it's used is that you have somewhat suppressed TSH, but your free T4 and your T3 are not outside the normal range. And you don't have another explanation for the suppressed TSH. Then you call it subclinical hypothyroidism. And the question is, what do you do with these people? There's a big debate, primarily driven by drug companies who want to sell T4 to everybody. And therefore, they want you to... For hypothyroidism, the TSH is slightly elevated and the free T4 and T3 is still normal, you call it subclinical hypothyroidism. So the drug companies want everybody on thyroid hormone. So therefore they say, well, the normal TSH is really 2. So if it goes to 3.5, you should give them thyroid hormone. I'm exaggerating a little bit. But whereas the range is that they give you in the lab is, let's say, from 0.8 to 4.5, if you look at the majority of patients there, normal people have TSH between 1 and 2. That's true. But nobody has shown that anyone who has a TSH less than 10 has any adverse outcome in terms of any clinical measure that people have looked at. So therefore, the purists, to which I sometimes group myself, say that why treat something is of no clinical significance. Could say, well, why not treat? Because ultimately, these kind of patients tend to become, frankly, hypothyroid anyway. What's the harm of treating them? The harm is that most of the time when you treat, often they get overtreated. They become subclinical hyperthyroid from the treatment. Iatrogenic subclinical hyperthyroidism. And we know that that has potential adverse effects. So if you treat somebody, you need to monitor. If you don't treat, you check it once or twice a year. So that's the argument against treating just anybody casually for hypothyroidism, subclinical. Now for hyperthyroidism, the argument for treatment is that a certain level of hyperthyroidism, that is, even though there's no clinical symptoms, can still have adverse effects, adverse outcomes. What are those? The TSH is suppressed and your free T4 and your T3 are still within the normal range. And clearly shown that this can result in two things. One, a slight increase in the rate of onset of atrial fibrillation. And that depends on your baseline level. So if you're older, you're going to have already a somewhat increased rate. And that is further increased by subclinical hypothyroidism. That's one. And the other one is that you get osteoporosis and increased fracture risk. And clearly show that lowering TSH without elevation of free T4 or T3 can, in the long term, cause osteoporosis and cause increased fracture risk. So that's why subclinical hyperthyroidism we treat, but most endocrinologists use a cutoff for the TSH. In other words, just because it's slightly below normal, I treat only if the TSH is below 0.1. Normal is 0.6 to 2. I treat only if it's below 0.1. The TSH is so sensitive, people with a TSH slightly suppressed have no symptoms that you could attribute to hyperthyroidism. Many patients have non-specific symptoms, but they're not due to thyroid disease if the TSH is greater than 0.1. And why does hyperthyroidism cause osteoporosis? We used to think that thyroid hormone elevation causes increased bone resorption, because we know for a long time that hyperthyroid patients sometimes get hypercalcemia. Maybe 10-15% of patients with hyperthyroidism will have hypercalcemia. Why do they have it? Because they release calcium from bone. And when you treat the hyperthyroidism and make them euthyroid, this hypercalcemia goes away. So we know it's from the hyperthyroidism. But for a long time, we didn't know what the mechanism was, because it was just assumed high levels of thyroid hormone would leach out calcium from bone. When they tried to do this in vitro, they found that you need enormous amounts of thyroid hormone to add to bone fragments that are labeled with calcium 45 to get any release of calcium from bone. So it never was a satisfactory explanation why in hyperthyroidism you have osteoporosis. You can get osteoporosis and hypercalcemia. So this is the era of molecular mechanisms of molecular medicine. We should really think about, when we think about patients, about what's going on at the molecular level. And it turns out that in this case, we know what's happening now. At least in mice, we know. Because somebody knocked out the TSH receptor in mice, the mice become profoundly hypothyroid. No surprise there. But you can replace the thyroid hormone, make them euthyroid, and they have profound osteoporosis, increased bone turnover like crazy, even though they're euthyroid. So then they found that in bone, on the stromal cells in bone, there is a TSH receptor. So what they did is made another knockout mouse where they selectively deleted, knocked out this receptor only in those cells. The mice were otherwise perfectly normal. Euthyroid, nothing wrong. Thyroid hormone levels are fine. TSH is fine. And yet they still have profound osteoporosis. So when then they took this in vitro and looked at cells and so on, they showed TSH normally imposes a restraining influence on bone turnover. And if you take TSH away, you have increased bone turnover and you get osteoporosis and sometimes hypercalcemia. So the mechanism of this in hyperthyroidism is not because the thyroid hormone is elevated, but because the TSH is suppressed. Well, that's why in subclinical hyperthyroidism, where you only have a suppression of TSH, you can get osteoporosis. That's the current understanding. It hasn't been proven in people because you can't do this kind of experiments in people, obviously. Okay. Enough esoterics. Come back to clinically important things like hyperthyroidism, differential diagnosis. So once you have made the diagnosis of hyperthyroidism, the next question is, do we need to know what kind of hyperthyroidism the patient has? Or since we treat them all the same way, it doesn't make any difference. Well, do we treat them all the same way? It turns out, no. And because of that, we need to know what kind of hypothyroidism they have. There's particularly, there are two kinds of hypothyroidism. One in which the thyroid overproduces thyroid hormone because there's a tumor that autonomously produces thyroid hormone like in the independent of TSH, which would be called a thyroid adenoma. That's basically a tumor that produces thyroid hormone independent of TSH. It doesn't require TSH. But the thyroid overproduces thyroid hormone. Of course, the most common cause of overproduction of thyroid hormone is Graves' disease, where you have stimulation of the thyroid by an antibody. Antibody binds somewhere near the TSH receptor and turns on the thyroid to overproduce, even though TSH is shut off. Something else takes over for TSH. And then you have the toxic multinodular goiter. These patients typically have a long-standing goiter, and as they progress over the years, sometimes they become gradually hypothyroid. Why is that? We know why it is, we just don't know exactly which genes are turned on. It turns out that as the thyroid replicates, the cells replicate, they sometimes make mistakes in gene replication in terms of some genes are not properly copied, so you get mutations, somatic mutations in replicating cells sometimes. And if these mutations result in escape from the cell cycle, then the cells start autonomously growing. And since they are thyroid-derived, they may make a little bit of thyroid hormone. If you have enough of them there, they can make you hyperthyroid eventually. In the case of toxic adenoma, we actually know the mechanism. A toxic adenoma is derived from a single cell in the thyroid that acquires, by chance, a somatic mutation in the TSH receptor, gene encoding the TSH receptor. So if you have a TSH receptor that is autonomously active, doesn't require TSH to produce the downstream signal, namely stimulating cyclic AMP and so on. You have the two effects of TSH. One is stimulation of thyroid hormone production and release, and the second is growth of the thyroid. You have those two effects, a single cell, so it starts growing up. You get a monoclonal tumor derived from this one cell because it has that constitutively active TSH receptor. And if that tumor gets large enough, you will produce so much thyroid hormone independent of TSH that you become hyperthyroid. That's the mechanism for toxic adenoma. If those were the only forms of hyperthyroidism, we didn't really care very much how to distinguish them. We can distinguish these, for example, by a thyroid scan, yes. Thyroid scan and Graves' disease will give you a diffuse tracer distribution. Scan is basically looking at functional anatomy. Diffuse tracer distribution because the antibody hits every single thyroid follicle. So all of them will become more active. If you have a toxic multinodular goiter, you see foci of hyperactivity because these are the clonal things that grow out of the multinodular goiter. So you have a heterogeneous uptake, distribution. And with toxic adenoma, you have the classical, what they call a hot nodule, because that adenoma is the only thing that takes up the iodine by the time you're hyperthyroid, because It has overproduced thyroid hormone, shut off TSH, and therefore the normal thyroid follicles that are there don't take up any iodine. And then you have a hot nodule. Only toxic adenoma will pick it up. That's called a hot nodule. So you can make that distinction. And there may be some significance because we do treat them somewhat differently. A more important problem is that there are some forms of hyperthyroidism in which you don't have overproduction of thyroid hormone. And the most notorious of this group is called subacute thyroiditis. Subacute thyroiditis was described, forget exactly when, in the quite some time ago in the last century, initially described by this guy Descartes. As a syndrome presenting predominantly in young women with extremely painful, tender thyroid and hyperthyroidism. And when he looked at them more closely, they had typically had a viral syndrome preceding this by a week to 10 days with a sore throat typically. And when they were seen, they had some joint discomfort, increased set rate. There was evidence that they had a viral inflammation. And their thyroid, extremely painful. I've seen a few patients like this, and they won't even let you touch the neck because they're so tender. And so, therefore, was thought, this is not something we need to worry about because nobody is going to miss this kind of diagnosis. It's so obvious. That was the classical subacute thyroiditis, and if you did a biopsy, they did on some patients, you find that they have a giant cell inflammation in the thyroid. So this is viral inflammation of the thyroid, and the mechanism of hyperthyroidism is that the disrupted thyroid follicles leak out thyroid hormone. So if they leak out thyroid hormone, you're also going to shut off TSH and become hyperthyroid. By measuring T4 and TSH, you won't be able to tell them apart from other forms of hyperthyroidism. Well, since they have so much pain and so on, you don't need to tell them apart. It's so obvious. Okay? But turns out, as time progressed, we started to recognize that this is only the tip of the iceberg. The majority of patients with subacute thyroiditis have painless thyroiditis. They don't have any pain. Painless thyroiditis. And it's probably not the same disease. It's typically not a viral disease. Presumably in viral disease you get a more rapid swelling of the thyroid, therefore you get stretching of the capsule, which is very sensitive. If you have a slow process, the capsule has time to stretch, you may not get any pain. And the majority of patients do not have any pain. So the painless thyroiditis is more typically seen in patients with autoimmune thyroid disease, like Hashimoto's. They have lymphocytic thyroiditis. Now, lymphocytic thyroiditis has several components. It has T-cell-mediated destruction of the thyroid, and there's antibody production by those T-cells and by B-cells, of course. But in the same autoimmune process, you have B-cell activation and antibody overproduction. So the antibodies can cause either hyperthyroidism or also hypothyroidism because they are TSH-blocking antibodies sometimes. And the T-cell-mediated process in the thyroid can disrupt the thyroid follicles and transiently cause hyperthyroidism. even though ultimately the long-term outcome is most of the time is hypothyroidism because you're destroying the thyroid. So this is the typical painless thyroiditis, and it's most often seen in the postpartum period. And it's also referred to as postpartum thyroiditis. Why does it happen postpartum? It happens postpartum because in pregnancy, the thyroid immunity is toned down. Pregnancy is basically an immune tolerance state. The mother doesn't want to reject the baby, even though some immune disease get worse during pregnancy. Let's forget about that part. Too sophisticated for me, but for thyroid, we know that the thyroid cools off during pregnancy, typically, if you have autoimmune thyroid disease. But once you get rid of the placenta, the baby, there's a flare-up of the immune system and you get reactivation of autoimmune thyroid disease. Within the first 6 months, it's not uncommon, and you get transient hyperthyroidism, worsening of Graves' disease, or you can get transient thyroiditis by increased destruction of thyroid follicles by the T cells that are in the thyroid. And that would be the postpartum thyroiditis. So this is a very important thing to remember because, and it doesn't only occur postpartum, it can occur even in people, and men also, that never get pregnant, to my knowledge. So how do we distinguish somebody with this form of hyperthyroidism from the one who has overproduction of thyroid hormone? Typical ones listed here, Graves, toxic multinodular goiter, and toxic adenoma. How do we distinguish that? Because before we start treating these patients, we need to know which form they have, because if they have a thyroiditis, the thyroiditis is a self-limited disease. Typically, resolves completely within 2 to 4 months. So you don't want to expose that kind of patient to antithyroid drugs, which potentially have serious side effects. You, God forbid, don't want to give this patient radioactive iodine. So you want to know that they don't have overproduction, that they have this form of hyperthyroidism. So how can you determine that? Well, the obvious test to get is if you consider the feedback. So you have an inflammatory process in the thyroid that results in excessive production, release, not production, release of thyroid hormone results in shut off of TSH. Now, in this case, it comes from the thyroid by leakage. In this case, it comes from the thyroid by overproduction. So that's the big difference. So if the thyroid overproduces it, it needs more iodine to make it. And if it is leaking it, it will not take up any iodine because in the absence of TSH, the normal thyroid follicle doesn't take up iodine. So the key test here is the radioactive iodine uptake. The radioactive iodine uptake distinguishes between hyperthyroidism due to overproduction versus hyperthyroidism due to passive leakage. So in this case, you have increased radioactive iodine uptake. In this case, you have decreased. Essentially, it's almost zero. Very low. So that's the key thing, that you make the diagnosis of hyperthyroidism by measuring the levels that we talked about. Once you have that diagnosis, the next step before you treat the patient should be the radioactive iodine uptake to determine which type of hyperthyroidism they have. Now, I didn't say anything about clinical symptoms, because nowadays we rely so heavily on labs that we forget about what the patients look like in many things. imaging tests, spend all the time looking at the computer, but we don't look at the patient anymore. So in hyperthyroidism, there are actually some important clinical signs that can tell you what kind of hyperthyroidism the patient has. And if you have those, you don't need to get an uptake because you know what the patient has. So if the patient has any of the pathognomonic features of Graves' disease, other than hyperthyroidism, then you know they're overproducing thyroid hormone. What are those pathognomonic features? So it's basically a triad. Hyperthyroidism, eye disease, and some skin manifestations. That's Graves' disease. And some patients have only one, some patients have all three, some patients have almost none, but the extremes are the apathetic elderly hyperthyroid patient only has tachycardia, nothing else. Looks like somebody is chronically ill, constipated, maybe a cold malignancy, and you don't even think about hyperthyroid unless you worry, why is the patient have a resting heart rate increase? Either resting tachycardia or atrial fibrillation. And if they have a sick sinus, then they may not even have that. So that's why we need to rely very heavily on labs. But on the other extreme, you have the patient who is very overtly hyperthyroid with tremor, heat intolerance, increased defecation. I have seen patients, frankly, psychotic with aggravated, severely hyperthyroidism, and so on. But you still don't know what type they have unless they have pathognomonic signs of Graves' disease. And one is proptosis. If your eyes are not just bright because you have increased responsiveness to catecholamines, which is the case in hyperthyroidism, catecholamines are normal, but there's increased sensitivity to catecholamines, so the patient gets a stare. From any form of hyperthyroidism, they can get a stare. But pathognomonic signs for Graves is proptosis. It means there's buildup of glycolipids, we used to call them mucopolysaccharides, in the retroorbital tissue for some reason, accumulates there, thickens the eye muscles and pushes out the globe. So you have either unilateral or bilateral proptosis. If you have that, you have Graves' disease. You don't need to ask anything else. Or if you have characteristic dermopathy. For instance, if you have plumber's nails, which we hardly ever see anymore, which is a significant nail finding that shows pseudo-clubbing and shortened nails, that's extreme form. What we sometimes see in about 5 to 10%, we see pretibial myxedema, raised lesions in the skin of the pretibial region. Why that occurs there and nowhere else, and why it occurs in the first place, nobody has any idea. But that is a manifestation of Graves' disease. If you do a biopsy in patients with Graves' disease who don't have overt, you find that they have increased deposition of these glycolipids there, also in that region. So it resembles histologically myxedema, and therefore we call it pretibial myxedema, but it's seen only in Graves' disease for some reason and only in a few patients. So again, if you have the pathognomonic signs, you don't need to do any further workup when you decide how you're going to treat the patient. I should just mention complete. There are some other things that can cause the same kind of symptoms and beyond the ones that I have on the blackboard. So increased uptake of radioactive iodine can also be seen in patients with molar pregnancy, with choriocarcinoma, for instance. HCG, human chorionic gonadotropin, is also a glycoprotein just like TSH. They have a common alpha subunit and a distinctive beta subunit. If you recall, there are three glycoprotein hormones, FSH, LH, TSH, 4, and HCG. They all have a common alpha subunit and a distinct beta subunit, for each one distinct. So it turns out that HCG has a slight affinity for the TSH receptor. Much, much less than TSH. But if you have astronomical levels of HCG, like you have in choriocarcinoma, you can get frank hyperthyroidism with increased uptake, overproduction of thyroid hormone. I've seen several cases. So that belongs in this group. Molar disease, let's say. Just in the pocket?
Yep.
Okay, I'm going to start. Today I'm going to talk about evaluation of thyroid function. Probably many of you most know some of what I'm going to talk about, but I think it's important to review that from time to time. So initially I'm going to talk about some principles about thyroid physiology, the key things that you should know. Then we'll talk about hyperthyroidism primarily, because hypothyroidism is pretty straightforward. So what are the important principles in thyroid diagnostics? Number one, it is the so-called free hormone hypothesis, which you're all familiar with. Basically what it's stating, that a hormone that circulates in the extracellular fluid can only enter cells if it's free and not bound to a binding protein. And in the case of thyroid hormone, there's a very extreme situation, more so than for any other hormone. And typically I ask when I give this lecture to have people make guesses, but let's skip that part and I just tell you what it is. The percent free thyroid hormone is 0.03%. 99.97% is bound to three different binding proteins. You may recall that those three different binding proteins are thyroxine-binding globulin, also called TBG, transthyretin, which used to be called prealbumin, but it's now called transthyretin, and albumin. TBG is a relatively low affinity but high affinity, low capacity binding protein. Because it has a high affinity, about 80% of the bound hormone is bound to TBG. Transthyretin has an intermediate affinity and binds about 15%. And albumin has a very low affinity, but there's lots of it there. So it binds 5%, roughly. So the difficulty in diagnosing thyroid disease is to assess the free fraction, the free T4. Now you might say, we have the assay. Why don't we just look at the assay? It says free T4. So why do we worry about this? The problem with the assay is the free T4 assay it's a rough approximation. It's not a true free T4 measurement. The way the assay is done, they use a low affinity antibody for